This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
People who've lost their homes, the 50 million who don't have health insurance, all the groups of people who've been affected by the greed on Wall Street, they have had it. Occupy Wall Street.
You've just heard clips from the Battle of Wall Street from Dissolve. Find it on YouTube. You'll hear more of it all through this program. Yes, retake the world for the 99%. From the occupied planet, I am your shadow, Alex Smith. We start out this edition of Radio EcoShock with an unhappy birthday greeting from Robert Walker of the Population Institute in Washington, D.C. Then we'll devote the rest of the program to an in-depth workshop on renewable energy, not for the big utilities, for you, for your home, cottage, or RV, with Bill Kemp, author of the Renewable Energy Handbook. You need to save money? You want independence? Think off the grid. Happy birth to humans. At the end of October 2011, the 7th billion person will be born here on Earth. With over a billion humans already going to bed hungry every night, this may not be a blessed event. Just 12 years after we hit the 6 billion mark in 1999, it's going to be a lot harder to look after the new arrivals. The extra billion people will find an unstable climate, declining energy and resources, and a host of other challenges. To help us sort out what that means and what can be done, we're joined by Robert Walker, Executive Vice President of the Population Institute in Washington. He's the author of a new report, From 6 Billion to 7 Billion, How Population Growth is Changing and Challenging Our World. Bob Walker, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Bob, you've been on every major television network, yet why do I get the feeling the average Western citizen thinks population growth is just a problem for the other side of the world?
Well, I think a lot of Americans, first of all, believe that population growth is not a problem at all, that there have been many forecasts in recent years that population growth will soon begin to decline, and that as a result of falling fertility rates, someday we'll actually be faced with what's called a birth dearth. But the reality is really sharply different than that. As you indicated a few minutes ago, world population will reach the 7 billion mark on October 31st. And current projections indicate that we'll add another 1 billion people to the planet over the next 13 years and 2.5 billion people to the planet over the next 40 years. And the real question for Americans and for everybody in the world is that population growth sustainable? And there are a lot of reasons to believe that it's not.
Well, aside from the chapters on solutions in your new report, and we will get to those, some of the most interesting pages to me were the comparison of global prospects in 1999, that 6 billion person world, with the outlook today in 2011. Why don't we start with something at the top of most people's minds these days, the economy? Can you compare then and now?
Well, when we look back at 1999, when world population reached the 6 billion mark, the human prospect overall looked immeasurably brighter than it does today. The prices of energy and food were at or near historic lows. Hunger and severe poverty in the world were on the run. The world was warming, but hopes were high that the nations of the world would soon act to reduce the level of greenhouse gas emissions and avert the worst effects of climate change. And the global economy was booming. It appeared that the United States and other donor nations would provide the foreign assistance that would be needed to accelerate human and economic development. And while there was growing concern about humanity's impact on the global environment, many people believed that world population would start to decline by mid-century, and that long before then, advances in the uses of renewable energy and green technology would reduce humanity's ecological footprint. But unfortunately, over the past 12 years, trends have not gone according to that script. Oil prices shot from $10 a barrel in 1999 to an average of over $100 a barrel today. The prices of grains and other essential foodstuffs have more than doubled. Hunger and severe poverty have made a substantial comeback. The fight against climate change has been nearly abandoned. The global economy has been battered by two recessions since 1999. Economic development assistance has fallen short of expectations. Water scarcity and resource limitations have grown more acute. And the transition to a green economy has not been swift as many people hoped. So we're facing a much different world today, including the economy, but not limited to the economy.
Yeah, I know. In 1999, peak oil was something for a few pundits that were relegated to the fringe. Now the International Energy Agency and the military even say we've passed the peak. Our civilization is based on cheap fossil fuels. So how are we supporting an extra billion people?
Well, that's the critical question, is if we are having trouble today feeding 7 billion people, and as you indicated earlier, there are about 1 billion people on the planet today who go to bed hungry at night. And there's plenty of reason to believe that it's going to get more difficult, not easier, more difficult to meet the demands of food for food in the future. We have to overcome a wide range of obstacles when we think about trying to increase food production to feed 10 billion people in 40 years. That includes, of course, climate change with increasing flooding, increasing drought, rising temperatures. But it also includes the rising price of energy, because that translates into higher costs for transporting food, but also for fertilizers that's used to grow food. We're faced with very serious loss of topsoil, with desertification in many parts of the world. We're seeing water levels drop, such that we probably will be able to do less in the way of irrigation of crops in future decades. So we face really some very significant obstacles to meeting the world's demand for food. The Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that worldwide we'll have to increase food production by 70% over the next 39 years, and that in the developing world we'll have to double food production. That's a very significant challenge, and there's lots of reasons to believe today that we're going to have great difficulty meeting that challenge.
Well, how do food prices compare in 1999 versus today? We all think it's gone up, but do you have hard numbers on that?
Sure. The real question for people in the developing world is, what is the cost of basic commodities like a loaf of bread, like a bowl of rice, or cooking oil, or so many of the other basic food commodities that we sort of take for granted in this country? And overall, when you look at the Food and Agriculture Organization's food index, today it's about 230 over a base period of 2002 to 2004. And what that means is that on average, basic foodstuffs have gone up in price by about 2.5 times. So that in many areas, for many food commodities, people are paying twice or even 3 times as much as they were paying just 5 or 6, 7 years ago.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We're talking 7 billion people with Robert Walker, Executive Vice President of the Population Institute in Washington, D.C. As you say, Bob, there are still a bunch of people out there who claim technology will support 9 billion people or even 12 billion people. We talk about climate deniers. It seems to me there are also population deniers.
There's no question that there are a lot of people who believe that we can just keep on growing the way we've been growing. And, you know, if you look back at the 20th century, there was a lot of reason for optimism. World population went from 1.5 billion to 6 billion in the course of the 20th century. And despite that growth in population, we saw a very significant increase in standards of living, increased longevity. And so many people assumed that, well, gee, we can keep on doing that forever. What they forgot is that we live on a finite planet with finite resources, and that at some point we begin to approach what economists call limits to growth. And what we're seeing in the changing prices of basic commodities, that includes oil and fossil fuels, but it also includes food, and it also includes other metals and minerals. What we're seeing there is a very pronounced shift in the last 12 years. We're seeing actually soaring prices for all those commodities, or virtually all of those commodities, and there's no relief in sight. So what that suggests is that the global economy today is overheated, and quite physically, the planet is overheated, as we've seen the fact that the last decade was the hottest decade on record, and that we're seeing a lot more in the way of record floods and record droughts. So So there's a lot of reason to believe that the fears that have been expressed for over a half a century now, that someday we would begin to reach limits to growth, that those fears are now beginning to be realized.
I realize this is a very complex thing to try and model out, and maybe we should leave it to science fiction writers, but have you come across ideas of what a world with 9 billion humans would look like?
Well, for starters, we do know that food prices are going to continue to rise, that the very sharp increases we've seen over the last decade will likely continue into the future. Various groups, including Oxfam International, have released reports indicating that food prices over the next 20 years alone could easily double or triple again. And that would have a devastating impact on the world's poor, particularly the world's poor who live in urban areas. Right now, we have a billion people in the world, actually more than a billion people, about 1.2 billion people in the world, who are living on less than $1.25 a day. And many of them are spending 50, 70, or even 80 or 90% of their income to buy food. So if we see food prices double again, the consequences for the world's urban poor who have no place to turn will be that they will be on the verge of starvation. Now, of course, many poor live in rural areas where they're sort of removed from the global economy. But even in those rural areas, what we're seeing in many parts of the world today is that as water levels drop and irrigation is no longer as plentiful as it once was, we're seeing that farmers are facing a very formidable obstacle to expanding food production. So to the extent that we're seeing a lot of population growth in these developing countries and rural areas, even there, the challenge is very, very significant. And I think the biggest concern we have to be worried about is what happens to the world's poor when the price of food goes up another 100 or 200%.
Yes, that may not just stay on the other side of the world, as we saw with terrorism as a possibility, or, you know, even just watching this on your big screen TV is going to be psychologically damaging for all of us if we don't do something. And I want to get to the solutions. I want to ask you one more question first, and this one isn't discussed at polite dinner tables. It's a bit of a risky thing for a media interview, but there is a suspicion that some races, religions, or countries don't want to control population. They want to win dominance by flooding the world with their kids. Is that just conspiracy theory, or is there some truth lurking there? What do you think?
Well, there certainly are some religious obstacles in some parts of the world, not in all parts, but in some parts of the world, to expanding birth control options for women. There are, in some areas of the world, a belief that modern contraceptives should not be used by women to avoid a pregnancy. And that certainly is an obstacle. I don't know that it's being driven by what you describe as a desire to sort of take over the world. But nevertheless, there are places where religion is an obstacle. And also probably a bigger obstacle, though, really is those areas of the world where there's real male domination, where women don't have any say-so in how many children they're going to be able to bear. It's no coincidence that you'll find that the highest birth rates or fertility rates exist in those countries where respect for women is low, where violence against women is high, where women don't have, girls and women don't have the same kinds of opportunities that they do in other parts of the world. So religion is a potential barrier here to lowering population growth, but I think it's more of a question of changing attitudes towards women.
The George W. Bush administration was famous for advocating abstinency as a population control measure instead of making contraception available. Has there been much real improvement with the present Congress or Obama?
Well, we saw in the last 2 years, or certainly in the first 2 years of the Obama administration, a very significant increase in support for international family planning assistance. In fact, we saw about a 40% increase. But with the election of the new Congress, the Congress that took place in January, we've seen a reversal of fortunes. And now Congress is intent upon not only reducing international family planning assistance, but also eliminating or slashing federal assistance for family planning here in the United States. We forget, perhaps, that many low-income women really depend upon government-run family planning clinics that are supported by both state and federal government funding. And we've seen in cases such as New Jersey where state support for family planning clinics has been eliminated, and in Texas where it's been cut this year by two-thirds. And Congress is considering a measure that would eliminate all federal support for family planning in this country. So we're seeing, possibly at the worst time, a real swing in the United States and even in some other donor nations, a swing against family planning. And that would have catastrophic impacts, both at the personal level for women, but also at the global level for world resources and the environment.
In your report, Bob Walker, you've set a big target for the United States for international aid for family planning. Tell us about that.
Well, we would like to see a very significant increase in U.S. support for family planning. And let's keep it in some perspective here. The United States and other donor nations spend very little in the way of support for international family planning assistance. There's today about 215 million women in the world who want to avoid a pregnancy, but who are not using a modern method of contraception. To extend family planning services, contraceptives, making those contraceptives available to those 215 million women would only cost about $3.5 billion a year. Now, by any measure, whether you're looking at the federal budget or foreign assistance or whatever, that's a very, very small price. And it's a small price to pay for a healthier and more sustainable world.
The emphasis is always on empowering women and giving them choices. We're starting to see a little progress there. Even Saudi Arabia promises to let women vote and drive by 2015. Is there a connection between general women's rights and the right to control family size?
We know that in countries where women enjoy gender equity, where their rights are essentially the same as males, that fertility rates are much lower. That when women are given access to contraceptives, when girls are kept in school and allowed to reach their full potential, that they're going to elect to have smaller families. And so there's a very, very close connection between the empowerment of women and population growth rates. And it's no coincidence, as I said earlier, that if you want to look at where birth rates are still highest in the world, it's in those developing countries where respect for women is low, where violence against women is high, and where women simply don't have the same access to education and other benefits that men enjoy.
Why does delaying marriage age help, and what can we do about that?
We know that when girls in developing countries marry early, and in some developing countries, such as Yemen, it's not uncommon for girls to be married off at the age of even 8 or 9, that they will begin having babies almost as soon as they are physically capable. In fact, sometimes before they really should be having babies in terms of their physical capabilities. And so when a girl, and I refer to a girl here as a young woman at the age of 12 or 13, begins to have children at that age, it's almost inevitable that they're going to have a large family by the time they finish their reproductive years, particularly because in those same circumstances, they generally don't have access to contraceptives, and they generally have no say as to how many children they're going to have. So we have to combat the practice of child marriage. Most countries in the world have outlawed child marriage and have set minimum ages for marriage. But what we need to do is make sure those laws are enforced, but more importantly is we have to combat the cultural attitudes and behaviors that underlie the practice of child marriage. And we have to make it worthwhile for parents to keep their girls in school rather than marry them off at the age of 8 or 9. So we can do even small investments like providing lunches for girls in developing countries. And we know that that kind of practice results in girls delaying their age of marriage, staying in school, and in the end having fewer children. So that produces benefits for the girls, for the women, for their families, for their communities, and for the world at large.
Where can listeners find the Population Institute and your new report?
Well, they can go to our website, which is at www.populationinstitute.org. And on the homepage of our website, they will see the report that is entitled From 6 Billion to 7 Billion, How Population Growth is Changing and Challenging Our World. They can also access on there not only the full report, which is about 36 pages, but also a two-page summary of the report. This is really what we declare to be a time to talk, and we're hoping that this report that we've issued will open up the global conversation about population and about family planning and about the empowerment of women.
As we close out, Bob, a personal question. How did you get going on the population issue?
I worked in this issue many years ago when I worked as a legislative assistant on Capitol Hill. But I came out of it as a deep personal commitment that humanity was really putting too many demands on the planet. That's one of the reasons why my wife and I made a decision about 35 years ago that we would not have children. We're not saying that people shouldn't have children. Obviously, we want to keep the human race strong and we want to keep it growing, but we have to keep it within the bounds of the planet and what the planet can support. And right now, there are plenty of signs indicating that we're putting too many demands on the planet, and that if we really want to raise people out of poverty and to stop hunger in the world, then we have to do a much better job of preventing unwanted pregnancies. And so I think this is really one of the most critical issues that the world faces today, and that the good news is that it doesn't cost much to expand family planning options. It doesn't cost much to keep girls in school, that we ought to be doing these things for their own purpose alone. Whether world population was growing out of control or not, we ought to make sure that every woman has the right to decide how many children they're going to bear, and that girls stay in school. These are things that we ought to do for very simple personal reasons, but we also ought to do them for global reasons.
Find the helpful new report, From 6 Billion to 7 Billion, How Population Growth is Changing and Challenging Our World, at populationinstitute.org. Our guest, Robert Walker, wrote it. Thank you, Bob, for sharing with us.
Thank you very much, Alex. My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Coming up next, energy independence for the rest of us. The dream and the need for renewable energy just keeps getting stronger. You want to help avoid drastic climate change. You want to be independent, even if the system goes down. Perhaps you want to live outside the grid in a home or a camper, or maybe you just want to save money as electricity and fuel prices keep going up. Everybody talks about it, but how can we really do it? We're going to get a fast workshop of ideas and techniques right now on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and my guest has the best how-to guide on the market. It's called The Renewable Energy Handbook, written by William H. Kemp and published by Aztec Press. Bill Kemp, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me, Alex.
Bill, in spring 2011, we talked with your publisher, Cam Mather, about his adventures living off-grid in Ontario, Canada. We shared a lot because I lived on a homestead without electricity for 10 years. Tell us about your own home living and experimenting with renewable energy.
Well, it's been quite a long time for us. This house was actually built roughly 20 years ago with the intention of being built off of the grid and trying to make it over time energy independent from all sources of fuel, not just from trying to get rid of the electrical grid, but also trying to reduce our propane usage, which is, you know, a very high proportion of the fuel use in most off-grid homes. So we started off much like any other design. Starting from scratch with a blank piece of paper really helps, because the idea is that when you're going to generate your own electricity, the one thing you need to keep in mind is that the cost of the generating equipment goes up very rapidly as the demand for electricity does. So really, energy efficiency is the cardinal rule with off-grid homes, trying to make sure that you're using what energy you do produce as wisely as possible. So for an off-the-grid house, which means that it's built not connected to the electrical grid and going to be completely independent, the key thing is to look at all of the electrical appliances and try to either do without them or to purchase those that are the highest efficiency. And I should say that really anyone should do this. From an economic standpoint, it makes great sense. And an environmental standpoint, it makes great sense. You have lower operating costs and less environmental impact. But it's doubly important in an off-grid home because of the cost of generating that power. We basically didn't want to do without either, so we chose appliances that would suit our requirements. and just bought the best that we could afford from an efficiency standpoint. So we still have a refrigerator that plugs in the wall and a big TV set and stereo system and the usual trappings of a middle class life. We also did the same with the house design, that we wanted to use as little energy to both heat and cool it. And so we incorporated very high levels of insulation into the house, south glazing for passive solar, roof angles to eliminate sunlight coming in the summer, but maximizing sun infiltration in the winter and that sort of thing. All in all, just producing a house that uses approximately one quarter of the energy of the average North American home.
And if you got solar panels going or a wind generator, what have you got going there?
Absolutely. So once you've covered the efficiency side of things, then the next thing is to produce your energy. So on the electrical side, we have both a wind turbine and photovoltaic panels that are mounted on solar trackers that actually follow the sun. And we have approximately 2,700 watts of photovoltaic panels divided between two trackers that follow the sun from east to west during the day and, of course, angle higher in the sky as the sun moves through solar noon. And the solar panels or photovoltaic panels and the wind turbine feed electricity in through a set of controls into a battery storage bank, which stores the energy as direct current. And then from there, the electricity is pulled out of the batteries as required. It's fed into a device called an inverter, which converts it back to regular household 120 or 240 volt electricity, and then out to the unsuspecting appliances, just as per a normal house.
You know, a decade ago, people off the power lines were kind of a fringe market. I'm wondering now, is it practical to use renewable energy even if you're in a city where the grid and utilities are right there and available?
That's a great question, because a lot of people look at this and say it's too expensive or it won't work for them, and that is actually not true. It's really a matter of designing for the right application. So off-grid homes are designed typically where the cost of the power line extensions to the property that you want would be prohibitively expensive. You mentioned speaking with Kim either a while back, and you know Kim is probably well over $100,000 away from the electrical line. So in his case, putting in a $25,000 off-grid system makes perfectly good sense. It gives them a great piece of property at a lower price because it may not be desirable to others. And obviously, he saves money on the capital installation by putting in the off-grid system. In the city, however, there are many jurisdictions now, and Ontario is one of the leaders in North America, where you can generate electricity from various renewable sources and feed that electricity back onto the electrical grid and get paid for it at a premium green energy price. And it doesn't really matter whether you've got a rural property or you've got a house in the suburbs. As long as you've got access to sunlight, you can even put very small systems of just a few panels on the roof and actually generate some income.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. In just a minute, we'll continue our alternative energy workshop with Bill Kemp, author of the Renewable Energy Handbook.
We are the 99%.
Wall Street.